number SCWC30692, State v. Rodriguez, arguing for the petitioner, Craig Duran, arguing for the respondent, Charles Foster, arguing on the merits.
Counsel, are you both ready to proceed this morning?
Yes.
Mr. Drum, so I understand, Mr. Drum, you want a, you're reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll put the warning light on with 5 minutes to go, and Mr. Foster will give you a five-minute warning when your argument time is ending. Okay, very well. Please, Mr. Jerome, if you proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice Rechtenwald, Associate Justices of the Court, and thank you for your time this morning. May it please the Court, I am Craig Jerome, Deputy Public Defender, appearing on behalf of the petitioner, defendant appellee Marco Rodriguez. We presented two issues in our application for writ of certiorari. The first issue was whether the ICA gravely erred by failing to disregard the state's points of error in their opening brief because the alleged errors were not brought to the attention of the circuit court as required by Hawaii Rules of Appellate Procedure, Rule 28B4. The second issue is whether the ICA majority gravely erred in holding that the trial court erroneously concluded that the state failed to present clear and convincing evidence that the contraband that was illegally seized from Mr. Rodriguez would have been inevitably discovered during inventory search, a subsequent inventory search at KPD cell block. With the court's permission, because I believe the issue presents more significant constitutional concerns and due to the limitations on my time, I'd like to begin with the second issue this morning. My opinion, this case presents a tremendous opportunity for this court to clarify the application of the inevitable discovery exception in this jurisdiction. This case also presents an opportunity for this court to reiterate the fact that the inevitable discovery exception is, in fact, an exception to the exclusionary rule. Professor Lefebvre once cautioned that in carving out the inevitable discovery exception to the taint doctrine, courts must use a surgeon's scalpel and not a meat axe. I fear that the ICA used a meat axe in this case. If the ICA's judgment on appeal is allowed to stand, there's a very significant danger that the inevitable discovery exception will become the exception that devours the rule with regard to searches incident to lawful arrest. In State v. Kaluna, this court recognized the impact of U.S. Supreme Court decisions regarding search, at that time, recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions regarding searches incident to lawful arrest, and this court rejected them as a guide in interpreting the parallel provisions of our state constitution. If inevitable discovery is used to excuse the unlawful search in this case, however, the distinctions between the state and federal constitutions with regard to searches incident to arrest will cease to have any appreciable meaning. In order to preserve and protect the privacy rights expressly guaranteed in our constitution, we're asking this court to continue to place reasonable restrictions on the inevitable discovery exception. First of all, we ask this court to clarify the burden that the government must carry in order to prove that the evidence would otherwise have been inevitably discovered, and also to establish a clear test of whether that burden has been met. Second, we're asking the court to make it clear that the state carries the burden to establish the security of the contraband from the time of the initial unlawful search or seizure up until the time when the subsequent discovery would hypothetically have taken place. With regard to the first issue, we believe that the test articulated by the New Jersey Supreme Court in State v. Sugar may provide some guidance. The New Jersey Supreme Court requires the state to show that one, proper, normal, and specific investigatory procedures would have been pursued in order to complete the investigation of the case, or that those procedures actually were pursued. Two, under all of the relevant circumstances surrounding the pursuit, surrounding the incident, the pursuit of those procedures would have inevitably resulted in the discovery of the evidence. And three, the discovery of the evidence through the use of such procedures would have occurred wholly independently of the discovery of such evidence by unlawful means.
Mr. Jerome, the state argues that the court should have made findings with respect to what happened after the defendant was arrested up through the time he was taken to the cell block and his possessions inventory. What's your response to that?
Well, my response would be, Your Honor, that the court could have chosen to make those findings, and if the court had chosen to make those findings based on the evidence in this case, I don't believe it would have changed the outcome of the court's decision, which I believe is why the court did not make those findings. The court's only required to make brief findings that explain the result of its ultimate factual determination. And the court's determination in this case was not based on the fact that a subsequent inventory search occurred or would have occurred or what the Kauai Police Department procedures for such a search are. The trial court's decision in this case was based on the fact that the state failed to prove that the evidence that was initially unlawfully seized from the defendant would have still been in his possession at the time of the inventory search, absent the initial unlawful seizure of the evidence. The state basically failed to introduce any evidence at all about the transport of the defendant between the time when he was initially unlawfully searched and the subsequent inventory search took place.
Well, counsel, can you compare this case to the Lopez case? Because we've gone over this ground as a court before, and in Lopez, the issue involved the search of a residence, I believe, and the argument as to whether the police would have been able to ultimately get a warrant and go into that residence and whether the drugs would still be present. Is that situation not quite a bit more speculative in terms of the likelihood of the contraband being present than in this case where, as I understand the record, there was a simple transport of the defendant from the arrest site to the police station. So in terms of the number of variables, the opportunity for things to change, the time period involved, all appear to be of a different quality. Can you explain how or what kind of rule you're advocating for us to adopt in this circumstance and how Lopez relates to this case?
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, I think the distinction between this case and Lopez is that we don't have enough evidence on the record before us to even be able to compare the two, because the only testimony regarding what happened at the time between the time of the initial unlawful search and the inventory search at KPD cell block was the officer testified, I placed him in my vehicle and transported him to cell block. That's it. One sentence as far as the facts and circumstances of the case. We don't even have any evidence, you know, after looking through the record, and I think it was kind of assumed, but the police officer actually never testifies that he even handcuffed the defendant in this case. There's no testimony as to the amount of time it took the defendant, took the police to transport the defendant. There's no testimony as to whether he was able to access his belongings during that time. There's no evidence as to whether he was observed during that time, whether he had any sort of opportunity to discard any of his belongings that were on him, and whether or not, you know, if he had discarded something in the back of the patrol car, if it would have been discovered by the police. Lopez, you know, the ultimate result was that there was no evidence that if the detective had been able to secure the search warrant, there was no evidence that the contraband would have still been in the house at the time the search actually took place. And here, there's not clear and convincing evidence that if the initial unlawful search hadn't taken place, that the evidence would still have been in Mr. Rodriguez's pocket at the time of the subsequent inventory search.
So you see this as an application of Lopez?
Yes, Your Honor. I think it's a fairly straightforward application.
What's the relevance of the independent source doctrine to the inevitable discovery exception?
Well, I think the relevance is that the inevitable discovery exception sort of stems from the independent source doctrine as sort of a judicial construct in terms of the independent source doctrine sort of gave birth to the inevitable discovery exception, and the reasoning behind the two is similar. The distinction is that in the inevitable discovery exception, you're not dealing with what actually took place. You're dealing with a hypothetical about what may have taken place if the initial unlawful search or seizure had not taken place. So in that case, everyone is speculating as to what actually would have happened absent some sort of illegality on the part of the government.
Was it Brennan who said the inevitable discovery exception was a functional equivalent of the independent source rule?
I believe that it may have been Brennan who said that, yes.
So at least in Williams, which is where inevitable discovery was first, I guess, expounded by the Supreme Court, there were actually two courses of conduct that were going on. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
So one was where the, I guess, the detectives obtained an incriminating statement from the defendant illegally as to where the body of the child was to be located. And the other course of conduct that was going on was that there was a search party looking for the body in the area where the defendant said the body would be found.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so I guess the Supreme Court said, because they believe reasonably that the search party would have found the body anyway, that evidence would be admissible even if the detectives had illegally obtained the information from the defendant about where the body was located.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So what's the parallel between that and this case?
Well, first of all, the distinction needs to be made that in Nix v. Williams, the Supreme Court established that the state has the burden in that case is preponderance of the evidence under the federal constitution. And the Hawaii Supreme Court in Lopez says that the burden is clear and convincing evidence. In this case, there aren't two independent courses of action taking place at the same time. There's the initial unlawful search of the defendant, and then there's a subsequent, I guess, lawful search of the defendant for inventory purposes sometime later.
So if we were to draw a functional equivalent between the independent source doctrine and the inevitable discovery exception to this case with respect to Williams, we would have had to have, in this case, a parallel investigation which would have led to the recovery of the packets of meth that was in the defendant's pockets.
Yes, I believe so, Your Honor.
And that was the situation in Lopez also, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because you had two investigations that ultimately focus on what was in the home of the defendants.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So you had Sergeant Magnini or Magnus already conducting an investigation of whether or not the defendants had or dealing in drugs. And so he had, I guess, focused on the street, but he didn't know whether the defendants were the ones who were dealing. But he focused on the street where the defendants were living.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And in the meantime, apparently the defendants were burglarized, and Officer Guillermo, subsequent to the burglary, made an unauthorized entry into the home and discovered drugs.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you had two parallel investigations going on in Lopez, and this court said it wasn't inevitable. You couldn't say that there would be inevitable discovery because you couldn't say the first investigation on drugs would have inevitably led to the discovery of the drugs that Guillermo had made in his illegal entry into the home.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So what's the parallel between Lopez and this case?
I mean, I guess the parallel between Lopez and this case is that there aren't any parallel investigations going on here. There aren't two separate investigations. And in this case, in Lopez, in Williams, the defendant in those cases is already under suspicion for the crime for which the evidence is ultimately used against him or her. In this case, it's a completely separate crime. The discovery of the methamphetamine in this case has nothing to do with the police officer's initial investigation of the defendant, which is initially because his safety check on his car has expired and leads to the fact that he has some contempt warrants. In this case, it's hard to even say that at the time of the initial search, if the initial search had not taken place, that the methamphetamine would actually be evidence of anything for which the defendant was initially arrested for. It's, at that point, it may be contraband, it may be something that's unlawful for him to possess, but it's merely something that's in his possession. I'm not sure that that answered your question, but I think that that's a big distinguishing feature between this case and Williams or Lopez, is that the defendant in this case is not under police scrutiny for anything involving the crime for which he's ultimately charged in this case, and which brings us here today. This is a simple case of an unlawful search, which, you know, is completely unjustifiable under the circumstances, and which leads to evidence of a crime for which he's under no suspicion at the time of that search.
Mr. Jerome, I have a question. I think you said that there was actually no evidence or no testimony that your client had been handcuffed. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
But Judge Watanabe's findings do state that he was handcuffed, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And did you challenge that finding?
We did not challenge that finding. And we actually, you know, the truth is that our proposed findings that we submitted to the court included that finding. So I can't, at this point, say that that finding is incorrect or that we preserved our right to object to that finding, but it's...
You agree with that argument, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
It's just sort of interesting in terms of the complete dearth of evidence that the state put on in this case about the circumstances under which the defendant was transported or under which he was placed under arrest.
You talked about clarifying the burden of the prosecution. Just with regard to this case, if the police officer had testified that it was his practice to conduct some kind of sweep or search of his own vehicle, the back of his own vehicle where the defendant would be located before the transport and then again after the transport, and had followed that practice in this case, or would have followed that practice in this case, would that have been sufficient to carry the state's burden?
You know, the difficult thing about the questions in this case is that everything is a hypothetical. So if we look at all of the evidence, I don't know if that by itself would have been sufficient to carry the state's burden, but if the state had introduced some sort of evidence regarding, you know, whether the defendant was able to access his pockets,
why wouldn't that have taken care of it? In other words, if the officer says, I check my car to be sure there's nothing in the back seat before I put the defendant in, and when I get to the station, I check again to make sure he hasn't left anything behind, that's my practice and procedure, I would have followed it in this case. Why would that or would that not have been adequate in this case? Because, again, as you noted, this is an opportunity for us to clarify the rule. And what rule should we put forth in this case?
Well, it's difficult to say because then the possibility exists that the defendant could have discarded the contraband before he entered the police car, after he exited the police car at the station. If he was left unattended at some time during the transport, he could have, and there was some way to discard the contraband outside of the police car. You know, I think that if the state had presented sufficient evidence to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the transport was secure, and if the defendant had made any attempts to discard or destroy the evidence, it would have been detected, then that would probably be sufficient to meet the state's burden in this case. And the dissent in this case says, you know, just because it would have been easy for the state to do so doesn't excuse their failure to do so. I don't think it's placing a tremendous burden on the state in this case to have adduced sufficient evidence to have met their burden as the law now stands.
Just thinking out loud, so is that counter to your proposition, though, that allowing the inventory search to validate the illegal search actually devours any protections attendant to search incident to arrest?
Well, as a matter of philosophy, I...
No, not philosophy. I'm talking about our case law. Does that in effect result? And so then later in these cases, we don't even have to worry about you know, searches incident to arrest, because whatever happened at the time of arrest or during the arrest doesn't matter, because inevitably the stuff would have been recovered hypothetically when the defendant was taken to the station.
And I think that that's one of the real issues with the law as it now stands.
But you just agreed that it's okay.
Well, I agree.
You know, as long as precautions were taken, whatever happened in terms of the illegal search would be validated, because it would always be, in every case where a defendant is arrested, a validation of an illegal search through the inventory search. Would that make our job much easier?
It may make this court's job easier, and I think that that with...
Is that what you're arguing for? Is that your position?
What I'm arguing is that the ICA should have required the state to meet the burden that exists under the law as it now stands, which they did not do in this case. There, in other cases, perhaps in this case, there may be arguments to be made for other exceptions to the inevitable discovery rule with searches incident to lawful arrest.
An exception to the inevitable discovery rule, which already itself is an exception to the exclusionary rule?
That's correct, Your Honor.
What would that kind of exception be?
Well, one of the things I would advocate before this court is that the court should adopt a bad faith exception to the inevitable discovery rule.
Okay. Well, you're taking us way out there. If there's a bad faith exception, then I assume you are advocating for a good faith rule.
Well, I believe that there's already a good faith rule. The good faith rule is the inevitable discovery exception as it now stands, which presupposes...
I've never seen that in a case law, that the inevitable discovery rule, is the equivalent of a good faith rule.
Well, at this point, there isn't. That's not the law in this state. Is that there's been no precedent in the state as far as any sort of consideration of the good faith or bad faith of the government agents. There's only two published inevitable discovery cases in this jurisdiction since 1995, and I believe that the U.S. Supreme Court has, in Nix v. Williams, rejected the bad faith exception to the inevitable discovery rule, but that doesn't mean that this court, at some point, given the greater protections that are offered by the Hawaii Constitution, can't adopt the bad faith exception of the inevitable discovery rule. And I believe that there are good reasons for the court to do that. That isn't something that was raised by the defense in this case, but I would argue, if given the opportunity, that the officer in this case did act in bad faith in conducting a search of the defendant, and that that provides another reason why this court should not affirm the ICA's judgment on appeal.
Isn't it a premise of your argument that the it should be anticipated that the defendant will attempt to dispose of the evidence? That's a necessary sort of factual or logical assumption, and then the state needs to meet that assumption or respond to it by showing that that couldn't have happened. Is that a reasonable assumption to make, or should there be some evidence to suggest that that's the case?
Well,
that the assumption is a reasonable one in a particular case, or should that just be a blanket assumption in all cases, that the defendant is going to or is likely to, or given the opportunity, will attempt to dispose of evidence?
I would assume that that might be a reasonable assumption for the state to undertake in these sorts of cases. The thing is, in every case when the state's asking this court or the trial court to apply the inevitable discovery exception, there's already been an illegal search or an illegal seizure on the part of government agents. The defendant is not in any sort of position to say, you know, if this illegal search hadn't taken place, here's speculatively, hypothetically, what I may have done in order to avoid the contraband being discovered at some time subsequent to that illegal search. The state is in possession of all of the evidence in these cases as far as what their procedures are, what their policies are, what's going to happen, whether or not they'd be able to obtain a search warrant. The defendant's not in the position to speculate as to that, and the defendant, and it's clear that it's the state's burden to prove that at the time of the subsequent lawful search or lawful seizure, that the evidence would have still been in the same place it was located at the time of the initial unlawful search. And it's not the defendant's burden to introduce some sort of evidence to say, well, you know, if the officer in this case hadn't come up to me and just turned my pockets inside out, I probably would have tried to stash the contraband or, you know, secrete it somewhere that wasn't subject to search, or I would have tried to put it in a closed container. All of those things are hypothetically things that could have happened, but, you know, the defendant's not in that sort of position.
The burden is on the state, in other words, to disprove those.
The burden is on the state, and I believe the ICA in this case shifted that burden to the defendant by saying that the state shouldn't be required to introduce evidence to exclude other possible hypothetical scenarios. I mean, what the state is essentially asking the court to do in this case is to accept its hypothetical at face value, where the trial court came up with a different hypothetical that's equally as likely to happen under the evidence. I see that my time is up. If I could reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
You may.
Thank you.
Mr. Foster.
Thank you, Chief Justice, Associate Justices. Thank you for the opportunity to argue before you please the court. This case is about what the clear and convincing evidence standard, the impact that has on the period of time between an illegal search that turns up evidence and that time, that later time, when that evidence would have speculatively been discovered in a jailhouse search incident to custody. The circuit court said that the state failed because it failed to prove with clear and convincing evidence that the defendant could not have gotten rid of the evidence. And that's just, that test is just wrong. It makes the state prove too much. The state's argument is that it does produce in the mind of a reasonable person a firm belief. If you say, police arrested the individual, they handcuffed him, there was something in the front of his pocket, they put him in the police car and drove.
Is there evidence that he was handcuffed behind his back?
I'm not aware of evidence that he was. That is the standard, and I don't know that that's the case here necessarily.
So, but there is no, first of all, there's no testimony that he was handcuffed, correct?
That's. I've actually been operating on the assumption that there was, and I think that's only because it wasn't challenged at all. So when this was being argued, I was actually tempted to pull out the transcript and check that.
Why would it be such a burden on the state? Why didn't the state simply on remand have the officer come in and testify that he was handcuffed behind his back or that he had a practice of searching the vehicle at the beginning of the transport and at the end, or any of the other methods of proof suggested by the defendant? Why did that not happen here?
Because that was not a requirement under the law at that time. The law at that time, under Silva, if you arrest the guy, put him in the car, handcuffed, and as long as the evidence isn't contained in a container, then it's good. You're good. That was the state of the law.
Well, Mr. Silva also acknowledged that he couldn't, I believe under oath, that he couldn't reach anything. Isn't that right?
I think that the court, the dissent in Rodriguez 2 and the circuit court makes much too much of that. That, the witness was testifying. He was not specifically asked that question. He was just describing what happened. He's saying, I was pulling out some things. I happily handed them to the officer, and then, you know, one of them was a pipe, two of them were pipes. So then I was handcuffed, so then I stopped handing him stuff because I couldn't get it in my pockets anymore. I don't think he's saying, I physically, absolutely could not have strained around and pulled something out of my pocket. He's only saying, by then I was under arrest. I wasn't free to really move around and do this anymore. Now the officer is reaching into my back pockets and pulling things out. So I think reliance on that blip of testimony is goes too far.
You know, I think the problem with Silva is, I read it again, and if you look at it, I don't think there was an illegal search. And the court said, hopefully, what I wrote was ambiguous enough, but when I read that opinion, I think whether you took the defendant's version, where he said, oh, I have pipes here, or you know, and he offered them to the police officers, or the police officer's version that he said he saw the pipe protruding from the pocket. In both cases, it would seem there was no illegal search. And the court said, although the majority read it differently, the court said, well, I find there's reasonable suspicion, et cetera, for the stop, and the prosecution says it was a good search or inevitable discovery. The court said, either way, you could decide. And then went on to find the clear and convincing evidence for inevitable discovery. Mm-hmm. So, the one problem with Silva is that I don't think there was an illegal search. And the court, it doesn't seem to me the court found there was an illegal search. It just said, hey, either way would work, because the prosecution argued both ways.
Well, and I think that the court didn't need to get to whether it was illegal or not, because they found that the inevitable discovery was met. And so it could have been an illegal one. It doesn't matter, is how the court came out on that particular question.
All I'm saying is less persuasive if you take that position, if in fact the searches were not legal. Mm-hmm. We're legal, sorry.
If I may respectfully disagree, because I think that Silva stands for the requirements of inevitable discovery, and I think the question of whether that initial search was illegal or not is irrelevant to whether inevitable discovery is met or not. But I do understand Your Honor's point as to that it doesn't have the oomph of our current situation, perhaps. But I think that what got us on this track is asking, why didn't the officer just testify? Why didn't the state just get this testimony? Because there was no hint. There was no hint that it was required. The defense didn't bring it up. The court never said anything about it. Came back downstairs the second time with orders to look at the inevitable discovery, at least have a look at that. And there was actually no new evidence put on. And there weren't, I guess the arguments were written in the form of the state submitted a memorandum, and the defense submitted findings and conclusions, and the court actually rejected the defendant's proffered document because I think the court had decided somewhere that it was going to use the distinction, the Silva distinction of the testimony that the witness, the defendant had said that he couldn't reach into his pockets anymore. I believe, reading the transcript, that the judge actually tried to get the defense to put that in a finding, and the defense didn't, and so she did it herself. Nobody had any warning. It came out of the blue. Everyone was blindsided by that, and that's why the state didn't elicit that testimony from the officer. And I would argue that the...
But you knew about Silva, right? You knew about Silva.
Silva.
So wouldn't you want to confirm Silva by showing that bringing in evidence to the effect that the defendant was handcuffed, or your officer handcuffed the defendant.
I think under Silva, if we had evidence that the officer had handcuffed, then yes, we would be home free under Silva. And I would go on to argue that the circuit court's conclusion of law number 8, that the state has to prove with clear and convincing evidence that the defendant could not possibly have gotten the evidence and disposed of it unnoticed, that makes, that without that, then inevitable discovery fails. I think that's just too far. That goes too far. I understand the court is looking for some ground, and I understand that we have a different, our standard is different. We have clear and convincing standard. And that's because we have a privacy, right in Hawaii that isn't explicit in the federal law. And
Mr. Foster, why does that go too far? You have the burden. It's a clear and convincing. In what respect does it go too far?
Because let me answer that by saying, when you look at what the defense and what the circuit court is suggesting the officers do, it's a charade. They're saying, okay, we all know that the officers have the evidence in their possession. Now, everyone pretend like that's not the fact. Let's pretend that the defendant still has the drugs in his pocket, and now you watch him like a hawk, and you strap him down so he can't move, and it's an absurdity. It's not workable. I can see this court constructing some kind of a rule that requires testimony of procedures or policies or habits or something like that. That makes some kind of sense to meet the standard that we're dealing with. But to say you have to prove that it's absolutely impossible, it goes too far because it's unrealistic. It's not. It's already in the mind of a reasonable person. As I said at the start, you say we've handcuffed him, hands behind the back, we put him in the police car, we go 3 or 4 minutes.
Yeah, but it wasn't. The evidence wasn't hands behind the back.
Okay.
I mean, if that simply, you could have called Officer Williamson, and he could have been put on the stand. Officer Williamson, did you handcuff the defendant? Yes. How did you handcuff him with his hands behind his back? Would he have been able to reach his pockets? No. No further questions.
And the reason, again, that didn't happen is because that was not the state of the law at the time this trial occurred.
Well, I understand you're saying that it's kind of in a fantasy world, mm-hmm, when you're talking, but inevitable discovery is something that the prosecutors use. It is an airy-fairy fantasy thing. I mean, why wouldn't you have to comply with suppositions about what might have happened when you want to take advantage of the speculative rule anyway?
Well, the state's being asked to negative any possible, really, I mean, at bottom, where does that stop? What does the state...
Are you advocating for a rule that says that if there is a traffic stop someone is picked up under these circumstances for bench warrants for contempt, it is per se reasonable to empty out all pockets? That does not violate the constitutional protection against unreasonable searches and seizures. You don't need to show that there's a that the ENOS criteria, instrumentality of crime or protect the officer or to prevent escape. You don't need to show any of those things?
No, that's not what we're advocating at all.
Okay.
We're advocating that if there is to be the burden put on the state to negative this the assumption, well, as the circuit court puts it, to prove that the defendant can't possibly get at and get rid of the evidence, there needs to be something more. You know, something needs to trigger that requirement. Because this is just, again, I keep saying it goes too far for the state to have
In this case, there's no evidence that we don't know whether, if we actually don't know, although there's a finding that he was handcuffed, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
And you're saying that he was handcuffed behind. And the evidence here is that it's Short's pockets, and it's the back Short's pockets. Is that correct?
No,
it's not even clear.
It was found in the front pocket.
Front pocket. So he was handcuffed in behind.
I'm not going to insist that he was handcuffed behind because I'm not sure about that. My assumption was or is that he was because that's how they handcuff people when they put them in the police car is behind. But I cannot say that he was handcuffed behind.
I see.
I understand that the burden of proof is different, but how can this, insofar as proving a negative, why would this be different from a DUI arrest when the defendant is put in the back seat of a car and the officers get on the stand and say he didn't have access to alcohol, and I searched my car before and after, and he didn't, and I watched him all the time, and he didn't have a drink, and that's proving a negative also.
Mm-hmm.
So how unrealistic is that kind of testimony? I understand the burden is different, but it is proving a negative the same way we would, Mr. Jerome is requesting.
It is. It's proving, though, it's statutory. It's statutory as to what the suspect in a drunk driving case can or can't do prior to a blood alcohol test. And so, first of all, there's that authority. They have to meet that burden by the statute. In this, and so that's very limited and it's very specific. In this case, I'm saying it's really, although we're talking about a specific example, it's not specific. What does what else would a defendant raise that the state didn't disprove? We're being asked to prove really vague, innumerable negatives.
Should, if we follow your rule, if the pockets were on the chest, are you arguing that it would be inevitably discovered?
The testimony is that at the jailhouse, all the pockets are gone through this, shoelaces and belts are taken away. It's very intrusive, and there's a high...
If a person is handcuffed in front because they have a shoulder problem or a rotator cuff problem, many of us do have,
mm-hmm.
And they're in a, causes extreme pain to handcuff behind.
Now this is the kind
of... Should your officers be allowed to just turn the pockets inside out of the chest every time?
Well...
Because,
Let me answer in two ways. And first is what you've put forward is what I imagine to be the defendant bringing that something else that I say is required. And that's
the
like,
defendant
well,
has the burden?
That is, well.
Is it the prosecution's burden?
No, I don't think it's a realistic burden. I don't think it is the prosecution's burden to prove clearly and convincingly that the defendant could not possibly have gotten to the drug.
But it is, you do agree that it is the prosecution's burden to prove that...
that the drugs would have arrived.
Would have inevitably been discovered, correct?
Correct. Clearly and convincingly. In the mind of a reasonable person, when you tell them the facts, they are persuaded that that's...
Well, knowing that it hasn't been discussed previously, but Mr. Jerome brought up the exception to the inevitable discovery rule of bad faith, and I believe in federal law, there's an implied good faith on the part. What do you think about an exception from bad faith?
I think it, the policy behind inevitable discovery and it is that, you know, the police should not be put in a worse position than they would be had the illegal search, you know, not taken place. And so you don't take away evidence from the state if it can be shown that it would inevitably have been discovered. I don't see how a bad faith exception, it either it was going to be inevitably discovered or it was not going to be. Now, I understand that if we go with a rule that per se, throwing the guy in the car and going to the police station, it's inevitable discovery, then it starts to make sense, you know, a good faith or a bad faith exception, because I know that one of the worries of this court is that we just are wiping out that whole doctrine of the illegal search incident to arrest. And I understand that. And so, as a way of addressing that, I think a bad faith, if a bad faith is showing, I think that's a workable test.
Good faith or bad faith, if the purpose of this, this inevitable discovery rule, the high standard of clear and convincing evidence, is to protect privacy interests, does it make any difference on the infringement of the privacy interests if the conduct of the police was taken in bad or good faith?
The thing about the privacy interest is that it bumps up against, in this case, I would argue, the interest in the safety of the officer. The officer, and when we, you know, when pat downs were first defined judicially, times were different. Now, you know, when an officer is patting it, oh look, hepatitis. You know, it's a completely different world. The officers, I think, are realistically afraid that if they're patting on clothes, they could get poked. And so the officer, apparently, they've been pulling out the pocket.
How could he pull it out without putting his hand in?
I think he, you know, took, my impression from reading is he took, you know, they actually kind of pulled it that way. I really don't understand the mechanics of, when they say to turn the pocket inside out, I don't know what that means. I don't know how that was achieved or, but my understanding is the officer does this because he's there's a fear of needles or sharp objects. And so, back to the question, privacy bumps up against this, you know, reasonable fears on the part of the officer. Now, whether that was reasonable here for the officer or to do what he did, I'm not arguing that, but I'm just saying that there's that balance, and that has to be looked at in that equation. Again, I would go on to say that the circuit court's rule is too much. I understand this court is considering some kind of rule, but to require the state to clearly and convincingly prove that the defendant could not possibly have gotten to the evidence, I just don't think that's a realistic rule, and I think it's wrong. And in any case, I think it really needs to go back down to the circuit court for some kind of findings, whatever rule is crafted by this court. Because
if it's your burden and you drafted the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and you didn't include it, don't you just fail to carry your burden?
Well, I think that, the fact that everyone is blindsided by the state of the law, you know, I think the state of the law was defined by Silva at this, in this case, because this is almost four, you know, on all fours with Silva. And so I think that the state and the defense, looking at the case law, nobody thought that was the state's burden at that time. This is a brand new law that the circuit, this is a brand new rule that the circuit court crafted. So I think the state, in terms of fairness, ought to be able then to go back to the circuit court and to see if it can satisfy whatever rule this court crafts. Unless there are other questions, I urge the court to not adopt the circuit court's rule. It goes too far. Bad faith exception, things like that. That's what I say when I say there needs to be something more. You know, the circuit court says the state has to prove clearly and convincingly that nothing would have occurred. To prevent this evidence from getting into the jailhouse and being found. It's too much, but
clear and convincing, however, is even a lower standard than beyond reasonable doubt, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So therefore, it does need room for, mm-hmm. it does not require nothing.
Yeah, yes, as long as a reasonable, you know, it seems, if you have a fact situation, And you know, we're talking about it like we're putting a new burden on the state. I think that burden can be shared between state and defendants in terms of, you know, the evidence shows, and let me just say, we don't know if it's the case here. You know, cuffed behind the back, put in a car, driven in the normal course as, you know, under normal procedures to the jailhouse, would have been found absent something. You know, something that the defendant comes up with, whether it was, well, I was actually, you know, cut to the front and I could have, I don't know, because, they're so speculative, it's difficult, but bad faith exceptions, something. I think something is required. Because I argue this, for the policy reason that for the officers, it's already difficult enough without every time they go to the jailhouse taking the back seat out of a car and going through it, especially when it's a charade, when it's just an exercise, because they already have the evidence in their hands. And then if we say, well, it's got to be a policy, then show that it's a policy, that's, I think, an onerous policy. Every arrest, that slows things down that much more, it takes that much longer to get officers back out on the street where their real work is accomplished.
Appear to be no further questions, so thank you very much then, Mr. Foster. If there's nothing further. Mr. Jerome.
Thank you. I just briefly like to respond to a few of the things that were brought up by the state. The simple answer, if the police don't want to engage in this absurd charade of pretending that they don't have the evidence, is they don't engage in illegal searches of people after they've placed them under arrest. This absurd charade only exists because of the prior illegality. The state is asking us to say, well, yeah, they violated your constitutional rights. Once they've done that and they've got the evidence, you know, they should just be able to drive you to cell block however they want. If they didn't have the evidence, they would have done an inventory search, but we've got the evidence, so we don't really need to do the inventory search. This absurd charade only exists because the police, in this case, are systematically violating the constitutional rights of the citizens of this state.
What about the argument that you, the defendant, or the defense in this case, didn't even raise these arguments in the original suppression motion in the circuit court? That's what I understood the state to be arguing, that the defense never even raised this issue of a possibility of evidence being discarded and the need to disprove it, or the failure to disprove it.
There was no need for us to do it in the initial suppression hearing. state had ruled in our favor on another basis. So, you know, as a matter of strategy, there's, you know, the state has certain burdens, and when the defendant is choosing to testify at trial or choosing to testify in a suppression hearing, if in the state's case in chief they haven't met those burdens, shouldn't it be the defendant's obligation at that point to testify and demonstrate how the state has failed to meet its burden? If the state fails to meet its burden as a matter of trial strategy, you're well within your rights to say, oh, my defendant's not going to testify. We don't need to prove that the transport was insecure. We don't need to prove that I could have discarded the evidence, that I was left unhandcuffed in the back of the vehicle. And the thing is, and I'm not suggesting that this is the case in this case, but an unscrupulous prosecutor who was aware of certain evidence that tended to prove that the defendant would have had the opportunity to discard the evidence, under the state's construct of their burden, could just choose to not ask those questions. And the state would still meet its burden unless and until the defendant came and testified and said, you know what, I was left alone in the backseat of the patrol car for 45 minutes, the window was open, I was not handcuffed, I could have grabbed the methamphetamine that was in my pocket and thrown it out the window and nobody would have been the wiser. And you know, this idea that somehow the officers' concerns about the officer's safety trump constitutional privacy rights is extremely troublesome to me. If the officer's concerned about his safety and he says, I'm going to disregard the mandates of this court and the way that I search prisoners after I place them under arrest, then the remedy for that is, okay, you can be concerned about your safety, but we're not going to allow you to use anything that you've discovered as a result of your illegal search. The officer in this case testified that it was his practice to conduct searches in this way. And this is an officer who at the time of the search had been on the force for maybe 8 or 9 months. It's not unduly burdensome for this court to assume that the police should be trained in the proper way to conduct searches incident to lawful arrest, that they should know that they have to do pat-down searches. The officer said, you know, I didn't have any reason to suspect he was carrying contraband. I didn't have any reason to suspect he had weapons. I know what a pat-down search is, and I just didn't do it because that's not the way I do searches. I search everyone I arrest the same way because that's what's fair. Well, it's only fair if you abide by the constitutional requirements that were set out by this court in 1974. It's not like this is a new practice, the pat-down search. You know, and that's why I believe that a bad faith exception would be so important, because without that exception, you do run into a situation where the police can say, you know what, I search everybody this way. Every time I have the reason to arrest somebody, I'm going to turn their pockets inside out. I know it's illegal. I know it violates the Constitution, but I'm going to do it because I know that if I then take the person into custody and I observe them and I transport them and they're in handcuffs, I know we're going to find the stuff at cell block anyways.
Mr. Jerome, if the officer had testified that he did handcuff your client behind the back, and I noticed that in your motion, the initial motion to suppress, your office stated that the evidence was recovered from the baggie was recovered from the left front pocket. So if the officer had testified that he had handcuffed him behind and then transported him, do you think that you would have been able to satisfy, do you think that the prosecution would have satisfied the inevitable discovery exception?
No, Your Honor, I see my time is up. Can I briefly answer your
question? Yes, you may.
Thank you. I think by itself, the fact that the defendant was handcuffed, if that was the testimony, would not have been sufficient to meet the burden in this case. It certainly adds more weight.
Testified that he was handcuffed behind.
If the officer testified that I handcuffed him in such a way that he was unable to access his pockets, mm-hmm. That may have gone a long way to satisfying the state's burden. The problem in this case is the state argued as part of justifying the search was that, you know, after he was in handcuffs, we needed to make sure that he didn't have a handcuff key in his pocket or some means of escape in his pocket. So it's kind of a circular argument that if, you know, if he can access means of escape when he's handcuffed, why wouldn't he be able to access the contraband? You know, I know my time is up, so if I could just briefly conclude.
Very briefly.
All we're asking is that this court vacate the judgment of the Intermediate Court of Appeals, affirm the trial court's order granting defendant's motion to suppress, and remand the case for further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement.